So we've been dealing with pieces of it that we've been building towards the full thing. And the nice aspect of this approach is that now all the pieces kind of slot together. We don't really have to see anything new. So we'll talk about electroweak theory, and we'll also talk about tests of the electroweak theory. Okay. The ones that I'm getting the most attention lately, and we heard a little bit about them in the Collider session, are tests of the Higgs boson, because that kind of was the newest and funnest tool that we had. But of course, there's a long history going back 60 plus years of evidence accumulating in favor of it. So we also have a lot of what you might call indirect tests, where we just observe all sorts of different rates in different kinematic phase space regions, and we try to understand, is it compatible with the model that we have? So before we get started, put up a few of the results that we'll need for the SU2 gauge theory stuff, but I'm happy to take any questions, or if there are things that you've been mulling over that you're confused about, happy to talk about that before we get going. Okay. So the electroweak theory is a gauge theory, of course, in order to couple the spin one particles in a consistent way. And we argued yesterday that because the gauge fields transform in the adjoint representation, there are the same number of them as there are generators of the associated group. So for SU2, the generators, there are three of them. For instance, in the fundamental, we know that because the SU2 group is the same as that responsible for angular momentum operators in quantum mechanics. So there are going to be three gauge fields associated with this, but we see four of them. So there's an additional U1 factor. So this is going to be the same abelian model that we were considering before. Okay, and this is called SU2 left, because this is only going to interact with the left-handed fermions, and that's going to fit in with the fermion mass story that we were talking about. And this is the hypercharge interaction. So we're going to have our four gauge fields. So, we typically call these ones W1, W2, and W3, very imaginative. and we call them that because the W bosons are entirely contained within those. And then this we'll often call B to distinguish it from the photon that we usually call A. And as you can see, this doesn't really match the picture of the standard model, right? And so the whole story is once you turn on the Higgs field, you give a mass to certain linear combinations of these. They kind of rearrange themselves into mass eigenstates, and that's what we usually talk about. But we want a sensible theory in the massless limit, and so we start with the not the mass eigenstates, but the kind of gauge eigenstates. All right, so we have our Higgs field, which now that it's the real Higgs, let's call it H. Okay. And it is in the fundamental representation of SU2. So it's a doublet. The group structure is the same as for a spin 1/2 particle. So this is a doublet. We often write this as a 2 because it's the 2-component element of the group. Okay. And then the hypercharge, which we denote with Y, is a 1/2. And there's different conventions. It could be 1/2. It could be minus a 1/2. That just basically takes what we call the Higgs field and swaps it with the complex conjugate. So what we do is the Higgs field gets a vacuum excitation value. It turns on. Okay. And remember that this Higgs field it transforms under this SU2. So maybe actually I'll write out the components of the Higgs field. Usually, we would write this as an H plus and an H zero. Okay, so it has two components. So the corresponds to two elements in the doublet. And the gauge transformations are just unitary, special unitary rotations on this column vector. Okay. So in general, it gets a VEV. We have to specify the potential. The potential is exactly the same potential as we saw before, except now it's going to have multiple components associated with it. But remember that this gauge invariance is just a redundancy in my description, so I can perform whatever gauge transformations I want. Okay? And in particular, I can use sort of SU2 transformations to move, if I have a column vector where I have an entry in the top, I can move it to the bottom. If I have an entry in the bottom, I can move it to the top. And the physics that comes out of that is all the same. So in some sense, This is just establishing our conventions for, like, you know, I have this field space and there's some symmetry where I have a bunch of ground states. Of course, they're not different ground states, they're all the same ground state. And I have the freedom to say, okay, it's here because they're all the same state, right? So I can pick where I put it. So the convention is that we put the VEV into the neutral. I mean, it's always going to go into the neutral component. I guess it just depends which one you call the neutral component. So it's going to look like this, 0, V. Okay. So basically, I have some gauge invariants. Higgs evolves to some non-zero value. And through gauge transformations, we can put it into a particular component of the field. And this, when we expand out the potential from exactly the same line of argument that we had before, the Higgs, let's hold off on that for now. Okay. All right, let's think about how the gauge bosons get massive. So this is the gauge sector. And remember, just like we did for the abelian case, we can kind of talk about giving mass to the gauge boson separately, and then we can talk about giving mass to the fermions. So we have this covariant derivative that's acting on the Higgs field. So the first piece is just regular derivative. And then I have this, you know, minus I gauge coupling times the field. Okay. So the hypercharge is relatively straightforward because this is just the same as the covariant derivative in the abelian case, right? Because this is a U1 gauge theory. So I have minus I gauge coupling. The charge of the Higgs is plus a half. So there's a factor of half there. And this comes from the fact that gy is defined as some gauge coupling, but then the Higgs has charge 1/2. So then this is going to be b mu. I guess I should be explicit and say that there's some gauge coupling gy associated with this and a gauge coupling GW associated with that, just to establish some notational convention. And then we're going to have minus IGW. Now, this is the non-abelian gauge part, so I'm going to have my gauge field, the generator. Now, this is a doublet, so it's in the fundamental representation. Oh, I missed an H here. So this is what the covariant derivative looks like, okay, if I want my kinetic term for the Higgs to be gauge invariant. So hopefully you can kind of see this by analogy with the kinds of stuff that we were doing before. Hopefully I didn't make any minus sign mistakes. Yes? Yeah. Ah, thank you. I thought about getting like candy and giving it out when people find mistakes to encourage you, but then the store closes at like 9 p.m., so I wasn't able to go. I wasn't going to walk a mile for you to have your candy, so you just get my praise and adoration for finding my mistakes. Okay.
In your pocket, if you like.
I do actually have some, you know, loonies and toonies, which I feel like these days might buy you like a 5-cent candy, so yeah, you're right. Well, it used to be a 5-cent candy.
I had a professor in undergrad who had like a bank of signs in the top right corner, and he would just take the signs every time someone finds a sign mistake, he would just take one of the signs there. And
that's pretty funny. It's like I have this reservoir of signs. Okay, thank you.
You know, Wheeler, in his graduate courses, used to give the pennies from his pocket to the rest.
Yeah. I think Mark Wise did that. He would throw quarters at PSI students. Does he still do that?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not throwing anything at anyone. We'll just make that very clear. Okay. So, you know, the Lagrangian for the Higgs is going to be this d mu h squared minus the potential that's responsible for symmetry breaking. Okay. So what we can now do is replace H with H, okay? And what this is going to do is it's going to pick out the mass terms for the gauge boson. Okay.
The potential would be in terms of
H or... Cool, thanks. So remember that the mass term for the gauge field is quadratic in the gauge field with some number in front. So it's not going to have factors of the field kind of hanging out there. Of course, as we saw yesterday, the mass term comes with certain interactions between the gauge boson and the Higgs field. So for instance, the gauge boson has a mass GV. Then we saw that there was this vertex that had Higgs with two gauge fields that also went like GV. Okay? But for now, if I just want to figure out the mass structure of the theory, we can just replace H with its VEV, and then we're good to go. So what happens there? So this derivative is zero because the VEV is a constant. We're going to get a minus I GY over 2. And remember, this H is a doublet, which we can represent as like this column vector. But this is a separate gauge field. So it's going to show up like as an identity matrix. Acting on my 0 of v over root 2. Right, because I don't want this field to transform when I make an SU2 gauge transformation. Now I'm going to have my minus IGW. And what this tells me to do is to sum over the generators, which are Pauli spin matrices multiplied by a half. So I'm going to get something that's like 1/2 W3, 1/2 minus 1/2 W3. So this is just the diagonal, the Z spin one. And then I'm going to get 1/2 W1 minus IW2 and 1/2 W1 plus IW2, where these terms are coming from the X and Y Pauli spin matrices. And there's some gauge indices on all of these, Lorentz indices on all of these. And then that's also being multiplied by V over square root of 2. So we're kind of reaping the benefits of what you know about spin. Of course, you could imagine matter fields that transform in different representations, then you'd use different versions of the spin matrices. So any questions about this structure? Hopefully, this brings back flashes, at least from your quantum mechanics course. But if not, I'm happy to explain any of the factors. Oh. So when we collect everything, I'm going to get something that's like minus I half gy b mu plus 1/2 gw w mu 3. The W1 plus IW2, I get W1 minus IW2. And the hypercharge has the same sign, okay, but the third component of the SU2 gauge field flips a sign because it comes from a Pauli spin matrix. And when I multiply this out, what I see is that this column is multiplied by 0. And this column is multiplied by root v over 2. Sorry, root v over square root of 2. So these are going to be the combinations of the gauge fields that get a mass. Then what I need to do is take this whole thing adjoint. Okay, so that's going to take this column and turn it into a row vector. It's going to flip all of the factors of I. Okay, and then I take and multiply these things out. Okay, what we're going to end up with are terms that are quadratic in the gauge field. Okay, and those are the terms that are going to get a mass. So I'll spare you the gory details, but what we find is that there are three linear combinations of the gauge fields that get mass. Okay. The first two are the mass eigenstates are the W bosons. These are 1 over root 2. W mu 1 minus plus I W mu 2. So it's this entry and the complex conjugate, okay? Because it's a complex combination of them. So I end up, remember my gauge fields, my W mu 1, 2, and 3 are real, okay? But this combination gets a mass is complex, so I end up with a field that is not its own complex conjugate. Okay, and this is what we have for the W boson. And if you do out the algebra, the mass is like GWV over 2. And this has to do with the fact that there's no hypercharge going on here. So the mass is determined entirely by the SU2 coupling. And so the W's lie purely in this part of the gauge field. The second combination, or I guess these are two, so the third combination is the Z. And it looks like this. So numerically, we now know that, you know, these couplings are about 0.65 and 0.33 or something. It's like 0.3 or 0.35. Okay, so this GY is smaller. So if I look at this as a superposition of them, it's this state that gets a mass is mostly comes from the SU2 piece. Okay? So what we do is rephase it so that we basically multiply by a minus sign and normalize the state so that we get canonical kinetic terms. And this weak mixing angle is defined as GY over GW. Okay, so basically what we're just doing is constructing a state of unit norm. And you know, we can take some limits that make sense, right? If I turn off the hypercharge, then the state that gets a mass should be just the W mu 3. If we work out what the mass of the Z boson is, it's MW over cos theta W. So similarly, we find that if I turn off the hypercharge coupling, the masses of the W and Z come together, okay? As we would expect if I only had my Higgs acting on the SU2 part and not on the combination of SU2 and U1. Okay. There is, we start with four gauge fields. So the last linear combination is massless. It's the one with the pluses in it. And you can just construct it by finding the state that's orthogonal to this and normalize. So it's going to be cos theta w b mu plus sine theta w mu 3. Okay. And this, of course, is the photon. So great, we find that there is a state that remains massless. And so my Higgs, it's not completely breaking all of this SU2 cross U1 invariance. It's only breaking a piece of it. Okay? And we can kind of see, remember, we need to have some remnant particle, the Higgs boson, which is left over. Okay? So at most, from the 4 degrees of freedom in this complex doublet, I need to have something that's hanging around. So there's going to be 3 Goldstone bosons that get eaten. So that tells me I'm going to break 3 pieces of the gauge symmetry. And I'm left with 1 over, which is the electromagnetic gauge symmetry. So we see the photon and Z emerging as linear combinations of a hypercharge and SU2 left. Any questions about this calculation for the masses? Realizing that we skipped over some details, but just getting the general picture. Yes?
Just correct me if I'm missing something. So that every field gets mass with the interaction of Higgs, right?
Yeah.
Then we know that a field can never interact with its own field, right? So how the Higgs gets mass? Like, it cannot interact with itself, right?
Yeah, so we saw this in the case, even in the case of spontaneous symmetry breaking without gauge invariance. What we found is that the reason why the Higgs field is far from the origin is because the minimum of the potential is not at 0, but somewhere else. But the potential still has to be positive definite, right? Like, I can't have a potential that rolls off forever, because then I wouldn't have a well-defined theory. And once I expand around the minimum, then the mass is just related to the curvature of the potential there. So the mass of that Higgs boson is going to be calculable purely in terms of the potential. Okay. So it, you know, there are these two parameters. One of them was like the negative mass squared, and one was the quartic coupling. We can also swap those for the quartic coupling and the V, the VEV of the scalar. So I can write the mass of the scalar in terms of that. So in maybe I'll actually write that out. So now in the broken phase, well, yeah, we'll talk about that momentarily. Keep getting ahead of myself. Okay. So we often say that the SU2 left cross U1y has now broken to a U1 electromagnetic. So three of the gauge bosons have acquired a mass. Okay. So that means that we have three Eaton Goldstone bosons. Okay. So we can see that, for instance, the H plus minus, these have to be Eaton by the W plus minus. Okay. And again, if I were to do the expansion like we did before, where I don't just put in the VEV, but I put in this, and then I add the Goldstone fields, what we would see is that there's this mixing between the charged Goldstones and the W plus minus. Okay. And then basically, the H0 can be written in terms of two real scalars, and it's the A0, the imaginary part, that gets eaten by Z. So we're left with some physical remnant H that comes along with this, right? So in unitary gauge, where I remove the Goldstones from the theory, my Higgs field just turns into a very simple 0, 1 over root 2, V plus H, where this is the physical Higgs boson now, okay? So I'm keeping the counting of degrees of freedom. So I started with four scalar degrees of freedom, and then each of these has two transverse polarizations. Three of these have gone into the three longitudinal polarizations of the massive gauge boson, left with one over. Yes?
Well, why does the last writing assumes a gauge specifically? Maybe like it's a, I'm...
We're just going to do that because it's the simplest gauge to do tree-level calculations in.
No, because I've seen that before, but I've actually worked with that, but I didn't know this. I never knew this assumed a gauge. I just worked with that.
Yeah. So this assumes a gauge. Yeah. Yeah. So in general, so there are other gauges, like the arc-c gauges. So in those, you actually have the Goldstone bosons in your theory.
Right.
And then you have to calculate amplitudes both with the massive gauge boson and the Goldstone bosons. And part of what makes those calculations trickier, especially at tree level, is that you have too many fields, the number of degrees of freedom. And so you need to have even more cancellations to make sure you're removing the unphysical behavior, the theory. Whereas in unitary gauge, I don't need to think of like, oh, did I forget a diagram with a Goldstone boson in it? Okay. The downside of unitary gauge is that the gauge boson propagators, like let's take the W for instance, it's going to be something like I g mu nu minus k nu over mw squared over k squared minus mw squared plus I epsilon. And if I compute loops where I have ultraviolet divergences, this kind of makes my situation worse because I have, you know, I'm putting in pieces of my propagator where I have momenta that blow up larger than I might otherwise. Whereas in, for instance, the arc-c gauges, I get like a k mu over k squared. And so that's not going to change the degree of divergence. So unitary gauge is really useful for seeing the explicit unitarity of the theory, especially at tree level. For radiative corrections, people use those other gauges because the divergence structure is simpler. Yeah.
In terms of the degrees of freedom, if I go to another gauge and do these computations using constants and three degrees of freedom for the bosons, what is happening? Because I'm like using three more degrees of freedom.
That's right. But remember that Feynman diagrams are not physical, right? The only thing that's physical are the magnitude squared of the sum of the amplitudes. And so basically, one way you can think about it is that I have the same number that's my answer, but I can get it by summing up lots of different ways. And so basically, you're adding more diagrams. But we know from the gauge invariant I have to get the same answer in the end. And so it ultimately, the choice of gauge comes down to what diagrams do I want in and how do I organize them. And there's some advantages, for instance, like if you're in the arc-c gauges and you keep that parameter arc-c explicit, if you do a calculation and you have a C at the end of your calculation, then you know what you've done is not gauge invariant. Whereas if you keep the C in and you end up with the C gone, maybe you made a mistake, but at least you made a mistake that's not gauge dependent. So that can have, you know, so for instance, if you're doing a really difficult calculation, you're not sure if you did it right, that's like a way that you can check it. So, you know, like everything in physics, if you think of these as kind of different bases almost, we always pick the basis that for the calculation I'm doing is the simplest one, but then we may choose to do calculations on other bases for reasons to highlight a certain physical effect or to check our work or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, you had a...
But then if you don't work in the unitary gauge, the Gaussian bosons would be the Gauss equivalent of the
Gauss. The Gauss are separate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It should be different, but then...
Yeah, so the ghosts are used to fix the gauge. So at tree level, we can just like put it into the Lagrangian and make these substitutions. But once I start putting in radiative corrections, you know, the issue is that if I, and I don't want to get too much into the details of this, but if you do the path integral over the gauge field, this gauge field has many different values that are the same because of the redundancy, and you need to put things in to remove those things that would otherwise give you infinite results, and those things give you the ghosts.
So when we say that we're going unitary gauge, we're just displaying the result in us, like changing, we are not fixing a gauge. That's...
We are fixing a gauge. So if you're used to thinking of the arc C gauges, the unitary gauge is the C goes to infinity gauge. So you can gauge fix in the same ways that you have already. So you still need to add ghosts, but those only show up in loops. The ghosts never, because they're negative norm states, they never show up in external amplitudes. So when we're doing tree level stuff, we don't need to worry about it. And there's a lot there. I will be honest, I don't do a lot of radiative correction calculations in the standard model, so I would have to brush out all of my QFT books to teach you that. But there's a lot of cool physics there. It maybe takes us a little bit far afield for some people. But. Yeah, of course.
And when the bed is changing due to temperature, the evolution of the universe, so then we would have a time derivative of the bed there.
Yes.
So we would have extra terms. Do they really appear? Are there new interactions or new things happening?
I mean, yes, if you have time-dependent fields, they can do things like do particle production and... you can actually have time-dependent fields that mimic a chemical potential. So, because time dependence ruins Lorentz invariants, right? So if you have an expanding universe, this is not Lorentz invariant anymore. And so you can do stuff like split the energies of particles and antiparticles. So absolutely, you can have classical field dynamics with implications. So yes, is the short version. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a whole thing called spontaneous baryogenesis. It's an interesting story if you look at that, where rather than having explicit CP violation that biases you between matter and antimatter, you have a field that's rolling one way instead of another, and that biases it makes one of the particle or antiparticle states energetically favorable, which of course is forbidden in a Lorentz invariant theory, but a GR is not Lorentz invariant. These are great questions. Okay. Okay, so hopefully by now you're convinced that we really need this SU2 cross U1. I mean, there's lots of reasons why we wouldn't get the correct phenomenological relations between the W and Z masses, but you also could see it from the fact that there are interactions that we observe, like W plus, W minus, gamma Z, right? The only way that, remember, these gauge boson self-interactions only come from the non-abelian piece. And so the fact that all of the gauge bosons are involved are telling me that all of these have some piece of the SU2 gauge bosons inside of them. Okay. So that is the gauge sector of the theory. Let's now talk about fermions. We're just going to do for one flavor for now, and then we'll talk about flavor tomorrow. So matter content, one flavor, or one generation. All right, so we already kind of, in constructing this, the naming is pointing towards the fact that the left and right-handed chiral fermions have different charges. So what we have are different fields for the left and right-handed Kalle fermions. So what we have is L, which is the left-handed lepton doublet. So it's in the fundamental representation of SU2. It has a hypercharge of -1/2. And we can think of it as a combination of a neutrino and a charged lepton. Then we have the right-handed leptons. This is a singlet under SU2, meaning that it doesn't transform at all. It doesn't couple to the SU2 gauge bosons, and it has a y of -1. Okay, so it's not a column vector. It's just like, there's a field. And again, for those of you who are used to defining everything as left-handed fermions, you can always, you know, the antiparticle of the right-hand electron is the left-handed positron. So you can choose that to be your field and this to be your anti-field. And of course, in doing calculations, that's usually simpler. But to avoid muddying the waters, we'll just write it out this way. We have Q, which is the left-handed quark doublet of y equals 1/6. And this has a left-handed up and a left-handed down. Okay. And this hypercharge, you can see it as the average of the electric charges of the two components of the doublet. Okay. If you work out what the coupling of the photon is in terms of the whether it's the up or down, remember, there's a sign flip in terms of the contribution of the gauge fields. This is how we get the correct charge assignments, if you're wondering. Otherwise, it seems a little bit made up. Okay. Then we have the right-handed up quark, which is a singlet. And it's hypercharged just like the electron singlet. It's just the electric charge. And similarly, the right-handed down quark, which is also a singlet, y equals -1/3. The five fields, not awful, okay, especially because some of them come bundled together. The fact that they come bundled together is really important. You know, when we were talking about people accidentally breaking gauge invariants, you know, people who work in dark matter physics were sometimes a little bit sloppy. Say, oh, I'll couple dark matter this way. Coupling up and down left-handed quarks differently, that's a problem. You can't explain why, because they come bundled together. So of course, you know, you can construct a theory that does that with, you know, putting appropriate insertions of the Higgs field in or other sources of electroweak symmetry breaking, but you have to be cautious anytime you see, for instance, left-handed charged leptons and left-handed neutrinos behaving differently, interacting differently with things. All right, fermion masses now. Okay, we're going to focus on the lepton because the quark cases are basically analogous. Okay, and we'll see that there's some subtlety in how the Higgs field appears in, say, the up quark and down quark mass. It'll be the same when we try to give masses to neutrinos that we'll talk about tomorrow. So we'll save that case for that. Okay. So the mass term for the leptons is going to be a coupling of my Higgs field to a right-handed anti-electron and the left-handed lepton doublet. If I were to draw this in a Feynman diagram, well, let's go to unitary gauge. Well, yeah, maybe let's first work out the charges here. So the simplest one to check is hypercharge conservation. So the hypercharges are -1/2 because it's an anti-Higgs. It's an anti-right-handed lepton, so that's going to be 1. And then this one is -1/2, so the total hypercharges interaction is 0. That is good. Okay, I always work it out every time because there's often different conventions of which is the Higgs field and whether it's complex conjugated or not. And then the SU2, this H star, I mean, we should really think of it as like the complex conjugate. Or the adjoint, and so I take my column vector, it becomes a row vector. So I have sort of an anti-fundamental representation, fundamental representation. Those give me a dot product that's invariant, so that's good. So now we can kind of feel free to go into unitary gauge now that we've constructed something that conserves the standard model charges. So it's going to equal minus YV over root 2. Now, if I work out the H star L, the V goes entirely in this component. So the H star L is going to look like H minus H naught bar nu E left. The V goes in here. So the only term that's going to survive is, you know, a V over root 2 EL. So I'm not giving masses to the neutrinos. I'm only giving masses to the charged leptons. Okay, and this is exactly what we saw last time for the expression for a Dirac mass. Okay, so what we get is the mass of our electron, which is YV over root 2. Okay, exactly the same as we did before. So that's nice. We don't give mass to neutrino, which standard model is massless. And in fact, we cannot give a mass to neutrino because in the minimal implementation of the standard model, there is no corresponding right-handed particle that it partners up with. Although we'll talk about that later.
If we change the gauge, are we giving masses to neutrinos?
No.
No.
No, no, no. So all going to a different gauge does is it means that I have this, and then I have the gold stones, which don't show up because this is a singlet, but they will show up in, for instance, derivative terms. So it'll look like this in any gauge, but then in the other gauges, you might have to worry about like gold stone interactions with these fields that come from the kinetic terms. Yeah.
Yeah, you can, however, so just a comment. So you can, however, add neutrino masses if you add the like SMEFT terms with even number, like
yes.
EFT terms with even number of Higgses and, you know, breaking lepton numbers.
Yes.
Undimensional.
You're absolutely right. And we're going to do that tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's so it's a cool story. And there is debate. I've had debate with at least one of the other lecturers here. Are neutrino masses in the standard model or not in the standard model? Whether they are or not, they are real, and we see them. So we want to think about how to accommodate them. And by analogy here, it wouldn't be hard to say, well, just like I have masses for up and down quarks, if I want a mass for the right-handed neutrino, I should just add a right-handed neutrino into my theory. And that's actually the simplest way of doing it. And we'll work through what that looks like tomorrow. Okay. But in the original formulation, people thought neutrinos were massless. They are, in almost every process, for all intents and purposes, massless. So this is a good approximation. Great. Other questions about mass generation? Yeah.
If we have mass for the neutrinos, does the standard model stay anomaly-free?
The right-handed neutrinos are not charged under any of the standard model gauge interactions, so yes. If you try to gauge, say, B minus L, then you have to be careful with how many right-handed neutrinos you add because you're adding a new gauge interaction, but with three right-handed neutrinos, B minus L is anomaly free as well. Yeah.
Why does the matter in the magic charge in the action?
Oh, sorry, this is the Yukawa coupling. We use too many of the same letters. So this is some separate coupling. We can call it Y sub L. It's a coupling constant. And it's defined, I mean, if you are a theorist, you might say, well, the mass of the lepton is YLV over root 2. If you're an experimentalist, you're like, I measure the mass, and I measure V, so YL, I get it out that way. Yeah, yeah, thanks for clarifying. Because it's too few letters in the alphabet, as we see. Other questions? Yeah.
So if you do the same for the quarks, you're only going to give mass to one of them?
You can give mass to both of them, yeah. So so maybe I can sketch that out. Don't need this anymore. So we're giving putting in a right-handed up and right-handed down field, and we're going to use the fact that the Higgs can come in either in the H or the H conjugate form. Okay, so let's do the up quark since that's going to be different. Okay. So what I want is something that's like Y up. UR dagger Q. Okay, so we can work out the hypercharges of this. So the hypercharges of UR conjugate is minus 2/3. This is plus a 6. So if I take a half, then the hypercharges add to zero. Okay, so instead of putting an H star, I'm going to put an H. Okay. You might worry and say, wait, but in order to get the SU2 singlet for this whole thing, I needed to have like an anti-fundamental and a regular one. So it turns out that the fundamental representation is what we call pseudo-real, which means that you can form invariants under the group with two fundamentals. And it basically follows from the fact that the Levi-Civita symbol is an invariant of the theory. However, if we think of quantum spin 1/2 particles, we can ask, how do we get S equals 0 from 2 S equals 1/2? Okay, well, my singlet state is going to be something like 1 over root 2 up, down, minus down, up, right? So I can take two spin 1/2 states and construct something that is does not transform under spin. Okay, and so if we do a similar exercise here, the invariant quantity for HQ, it's going to be like up, so it's going to be like H plus, and then the spin down component of the quark, which is E minus, minus H, oh sorry, not, we're doing the lepton quark, so this is going to be up, no, down, minus H0, up. And you see that both of these have the same electric charge of 2/3. I put in a VEV in here, and this is going to give me a UR dagger UL. Fine, I save myself time for neutrinos, because this is also, if you add a right-handed neutrino, how that gets mass as well. So we basically have two different types of masses, one where you have an H star in it, one where you have an H. In the standard model, this is totally fine. In supersymmetric theories, it's not fine, because you're not allowed to put stars on your superpotential fields. And so in supersymmetric theories, you actually need two Higgses to give mass, some to the up-type particles and some to the down-type. But you know, we haven't seen evidence of supersymmetry, so we're just going to do this. Yeah, it's a great question. Other questions about mass generation? OK. So the whole point of doing all of this is that we want to unitarize vector boson scattering. So we are not going to do the calculation, but I'll at least sketch out the diagrams. So we might be interested, for instance, in the high energy limit of the theory, because that was the one where we might worry about the behavior of different things. So vector boson scattering. Okay. If I, for instance, have like ZZ to WW, we get, so we're mostly interested in the scattering of the longitudinal modes, because those are the ones that can blow up. So we have a four-point vertex. We have two diagrams with three-point vertices. Okay. And each of these diagrams, just like in the abelian case, grow with the matrix element grows with energy. So the matrix element goes like S over mw squared, or S over mz squared. So you get this blow up of as I go to higher and higher energies. But we now also have a diagram with a Higgs in it. And remember that the crucial coupling is the gauge boson Higgs coupling. So this is the piece that is the hallmark of the Higgs mechanism. So this also blows up in the same way. And when you add them together, you get something that is unitary. So the S over M squared growth associated with each pair of gauge boson propagators cancels in this calculation. And this is, you know, another sign that the Schoenberg limit doesn't work here, because we're giving mass to fermions and because we can't decouple the charges. So we absolutely need a Higgs boson in the theory. And if there was no Higgs boson below about 1 TeV, then you would violate perturbative unitarity. in root S above a TeV. So the exciting prospect for the LHC is that it was kind of a no-lose situation. You would either discover a Higgs boson at a mass below a TeV, or you would have this growth in the cross-section, and something would have to kick in at a TeV. Maybe it would be strong dynamics. Maybe it would be something else entirely. Maybe it would just stay in some kind of conformal strong interaction thing. But you would have to see something in vector boson scattering. We saw a Higgs. So that actually makes it really harder to measure this process, because the Higgs is canceling this growth, which is what we want. So that then makes it hard to observe vector boson scattering at high energies, because the rate drops as you go to higher and higher center of mass energies. So we're sort of victims of our own success. This is a process that we'd really love to study, but it's very hard when you're colliding protons. Each of those protons needs to, each of the quark in each proton needs to radiate a gauge boson. That's a relatively rare process. It requires high energies. So, so this is the reason why we do all of this, is so that this process doesn't blow up. We have a nice theory where as you go to higher and higher energies, it looks more and more like you have a restored electroweak symmetry. I think it's also worth pointing out, and we'll see this when we look at some plots, that when you're testing the standard model, a natural thing to do is to say, well, these couplings are predicted by the theory. But what if they were different, right? Like, what if the LHC had measured a Higgs to ZZ coupling that was a factor of 2 larger than what it should be in the standard model? Then actually, that would spoil the cancellation. You would start to see this growth in energy again. Okay? It might be slowed down by the presence of the Higgs boson, but if there's any deviation of the coupling, eventually the longitudinal polarizations are going to catch up to you. And that's a hallmark that you can't just move away from that limit. You need to have some other dynamical explanation. Maybe there's, again, some strong dynamics at 10 TeV instead of 1 TeV. Or maybe there are new Higgs states lying around that modify the coupling structure. But by doing precision tests of these couplings, we're implicitly testing the unitarization hypothesis. And the closer we get to the standard model value, the higher in energy you go before the theory breaks down. Once you're above a few TeV, the LHC doesn't really have a hope of seeing that. But maybe at a future collider, you could see new stuff that's kicking around at 10 TeV. Yeah?
Are you familiar with how successful the Higgs is at unitarization so far?
That's a great question. How successful is it at unitarization? We haven't measured this directly, so TBD. But if you extract, if you do a fit of all the data, and I'll show you this in a few minutes, what we see is that it's consistent with all standard model-like couplings. So in that sense, within the uncertainties of what the LHC measurements have done, we could be exactly on the unitarity limit. So as far as we know, the standard model could be valid up to arbitrarily high energies. But let's say in run 3 or a high luminosity LHC or at a Higgs factor, you were to detect some significant deviation. Then you could, just like in the 1980s, presumably, or 70s. I can't remember exactly who did this calculation first, but I did read the paper last week. They were projecting, of course, at that time, these were like unimaginably high energies, but you can make an estimate of where a perturbative unitarity breaks down. So if we were to see a deviation in couplings, you could make a similar prediction that, like, I know that something has to kick in by this scale, otherwise I'm sunk. Maybe we could use that to motivate a muon collider or something. So it would be great. Let's all cross our fingers and wish that we see something that deviates from the standard model expectation. There's some other interesting properties in the high energy limit. And if you ever had to do one of these calculations, like I remember I had to do this in a quantum field theory class. It's kind of awful, right? You have to calculate all these diagrams. And the more complicated the calculation, the more likely you are to make a mistake. And that's a really bad thing when you're relying on intricate cancellations. So it turns out that there is a nice theorem that allows us to more simply calculate what goes on in the high energy limit. So we're going to consider an example first, which is going to motivate this. Okay, and this is top quark decay. And this is maybe the most straightforward calculation, or one of the most straightforward calculations you can imagine. I have a top quark, goes to a bottom quark, a W boson. It's just a 1 to 2 decay. The matrix element is just the gauge coupling over root 2 for the normalization, u bar b gamma mu left-handed projector on ut times the gauge boson polarization for the w. So this is looks a lot like the one of the diagrams I drew, you know, on the first day. Okay, when we compute the squared spin sum squared matrix element, I'm going to get, you know, coupling squared. I'm going to get a bunch of traces of gamma matrices, which are ultimately not that interesting because in this 1-2 process, the only Lorentz invariants are masses of particles. So I'm going to get something relatively simple. And then when I sum over polarizations of the W bosons, I'm going to get something that looks like this. And here is the 1 over mass squared piece associated with von Schuler polarization. So that's the part that we might worry about in the high energy limit. So you grind through the calculation, and I'm going to express the answer in the top mass much higher than W mass limit.
It's relatively simple, both literally and figuratively.
Pardon me?
I said it's relatively simple, it's both literally and figuratively.
Yes, exactly. So that's why it's a cool example. Okay. Here, there's the decay rate of a top quark. I go, ugh. Didn't I tell you, watch out for 1 over mass squared, right? So we did this calculation. We saw 1 over mass squared. So my worry is this a problem. But if we think carefully, this is not an energy over mass squared. This is like a ratio of masses. So we can remind ourselves of the mass relation. So in the standard model, the top quark mass is the top Yukawa coupling times v over root 2. Mw is the weak gauge coupling, v over 2. So if I calculate this, what this turns into is gw squared m top over 64 pi times 2 top Yukawa squared over GW squared. So I go, OK, that's weird. The weak couplings cancel. And what I'm left with is something that's y top squared over 32 pi times m top. So my answer depends on the Yukawa coupling, not on the gauge coupling, which might seem weird because it looks like I'm coupling to a gauge boson. But what this calculation is telling me is, oh, there's actually a top Yukawa coupling that's showing up. Okay, and this comes because there's a V in this mass and a V in that mass, and they cancel each other out. So what we find.
Is that the goldstone inside the W?
It is absolutely the goldstone inside of the W, right? I could, in the non-unitary gauge, have drawn a diagram that's like T B H plus.
Right.
And if I were to calculate that, I would have gotten exactly the same thing. And maybe that's not surprising, right? Because it's the fact that the longitudinal polarization is secretly a goldstone of the Higgs sector, right? That's kind of the whole point of the Higgs mechanism. So that when I'm at high energies and most of these W's are longitudinally polarized W's, actually it turns into this. Okay. So I can actually think of at high energies amplitudes involving the gauge bosons, I'll just call them V generically, are equal to up to a phase to amplitudes involving the Goldstone boson for longitudinal polarizations. And high energies means, E much, much bigger than the mass of the gauge boson, right? So as I go into the high energy limit, the unitarization of the theory is telling me that, I'm kind of delving into the structure of the gauge bosons, and they're breaking back into a longitudinal piece, which belongs in the scalar sector, transverse piece that belongs in the gauge sector. So this is actually OK to have a 1 over m squared, as long as that 1 over m squared is secretly hiding a Yukawa coupling. Yes?
Yeah. where does the nine get that cancels with the other nine? Where does this factor of nine come from?
Factor of nine.
Like in the, so when you, it's a G,
GW.
Oh, yeah, right.
This is GW.
Oh, yeah, right.
GW, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks. So another way of putting it is that at high energies, calculating in terms of the gauge bosons is kind of messy because I've artificially, I've kind of broken my gauge, explicit gauge invariance, and I've hidden pieces of the fields in various other fields. Then at high energies, where I don't care about the masses of the gauge bosons, it's much simpler to break them into transverse polarizations and then the Goldstones, which is matching the kind of unbroken phase. And that's sort of what we had been arguing last time. Okay. So this is actually can be formalized into something called the Goldstone boson equivalence theorem. Which basically says that, you know, if I have some process x to y plus a longitudinally polarized gauge boson, that that's equal up to a phase to the same process with the corresponding Goldstone boson when the energy of the gauge boson is large compared to its mass. So this can help at least convince us that our theory makes sense or check some of the more complicated calculations. So there's a nice example, which you can find, for instance, in Peskin and Schroeder, where you look at E plus E minus to W longitudinal plus W longitudinal minus. Okay. And in the Goldstone boson equivalence theory picture at high energies, this is E plus E minus goes to pi plus pi minus, or I guess H, I should call them H plus H minus because that's what we're calling them. But these are the Eaton parts of the Higgs field. And this picture is pretty easy because remember, the Yukawa coupling for the electron, it's M E over V times root 2. This thing's like 10 to the minus 6. Right? It's very, very small. The electron mass is well, well below the electroweak scale. So the Goldstone bosons don't directly couple to the electron. However, I can have this where these annihilate into, say, a gamma and a Z, or equivalently, a y and a w3, and those certainly couple to the Goldstone boson. So I basically have one diagram, and there's no longitudinal polarizations anywhere. Okay, so this is manifestly unitary, right? There's no polarizations that give me energies over masses. So if I use the Goldstone boson equivalence theorem, I can quickly check that, yeah, in the standard model, this is going to not blow up. There's one diagram. In the gauge picture, it's more complicated because, again, we have these intricate cancellations. So I have, for instance, E plus E minus gamma Z WW. We also have a T-channel diagram. And each of these has a what appears to be a bad growth in the rate with energy. When I sum them, I get something that's unitary. There's no Higgs involved here, right? But if I don't have the neutrino, I've broken my SU2 gauge invariance explicitly, right? So what this cancellation is telling me is that if I only had a theory with electrons and not with neutrinos, I violate gauge invariance, I couple the longitudinal polarizations. Okay. This is a much harder calculation to do. If you look in Peskin, I think it's section 21.2, it's like 5 pages of awful stuff. And after all the dust settles and you take the high energy limit, it's like, oh, this calculation, you know, he's like, look at chapter 4, the results from it's basically scalar QED. Now, of course, if you don't want the strictly high energy limit or you want the coupling of the transverse polarizations, you need to just do it. But this is another cross-check that you can do. Or if you're an experimentalist, you can ask your theory friends to do. If they present you with a model that's like, hey, I have this 1 over m gauge boson squared in the rate, then you're like, this had better secretly be a Goldstone emission. Show me the diagrams of that and convince me that this is the rate that you should be seeing. Then it's okay. Questions about this? Yeah.
In the diagram on top, you have gamma z, and then what's in the brackets?
So because we're in the massless limit, I can either use the mass eigenstate basis or, oh, sorry, these are B. Hypercharged gauge boson and the W3 gauge boson, yeah. And of course, I'm going to get all of the other combinations. I'm going to get like, you know, W2 gives me, you know, a neutral H and a charged H, and I have all of those combinations, right? So in the high energy limit, where I can neglect the mass difference between the W and Z, and things kind of separate back into their components, I should recover the SU2 invariance of that. So in terms of the Goldstones, usually it's better to work in the gauge basis. It kind of makes sense, a little bit more sense, how things couple. Other questions about this? OK, so maybe the summary of this part is that, you know, m fermion squared or m something squared over m gauge boson squared, OK, if it secretly turns into a Yukawa squared. But there's still unitarity constraints on this, right? Like if I made the top mass arbitrarily heavy, I would violate unitarity because my Yukawa coupling is violating unitarity. And that kind of makes sense because the top quark has to be part of SU2 doublet. Right? So I can't just decouple the top quark and preserve my SU2 gauge invariant. So there's all of these things, this kind of non-decoupling stuff. But at least I've recast my unitarity problem of Goldstone or longitudinal polarizations into a unitarity problem involving the, is the Yukawa just so big that I lose control over my theory perturbatively? OK. We are very, very shortly going to look at experimental results, I promise. But there's one more thing that I think is worth mentioning, which is that there's another loophole. So I don't know if it's the last loophole, but it's the last loophole that I will talk about. And this is a theory with a cutoff. Okay, meaning like that theory just doesn't make sense above this scale anymore. Can anyone think of any massive spin one particles that are not the ones that we've talked about here, but that exist in nature? We've heard about some of them in the collider lectures. Massive spin one particles.
The composites count.
Of course. Yeah.
Pions.
Well, so pions are spin zero, but you're getting very close. Yeah.
I mean the like low energy theories where you have like, for example, you know, theories where you can integrate out W bosons, for example, Z bosons, that these would be theories with a cutoff. Right?
Yes, yeah. So integrating out the Ws would give you a theory with a cutoff. But in the standard, it's hard to imagine that because we know that that's not what happens, right? Like we know, we tend to think in terms of the fundamental degrees of freedom of SU2, and so we think of it as a theory that kind of goes up indefinitely. But you're right, if I were to just remove the Ws, that would be an effective field theory that has a cutoff. Yeah. Massive spin one particles, nobody.
Sorry?
Massive spin one particles, no one can name.
Massive. Oh,
massive. With a mass. What was that particle that you could look in mu plus mu minus? Not the Z at low energies.
James
Hai. James Hai, okay. Rho mesons, omega mesons, phi mesons. Do you not learn about this stuff anymore? Okay. Back in the Stone Age, I also didn't really learn about this, but I work on a low energy experiment where we have to think about such things. So there's a whole host of vector mesons, which are composite, right? They are not fundamental. Rho, omega, phi. So this is SS bar. This is isospin 1. This is isospin 0, if you care about these sorts of things. But these are all vector mesons. They have masses. For instance, the mass of the rho is 770 MeV. Okay, and this theory has a cutoff, namely that if I go to high enough energies, these literally break apart into the constituent quarks, and then I don't have a spin one particle with the mass anymore, and I don't worry about it. Right? So you might think, OK, that's basically all there is to the story. But it turns out that there's actually something more that you can say, which is that if the vector mesons are light, and this is maybe of questionable truth in the standard model. But what we mean here is that I have some cutoff of my theory, and then I have some range of energy scales. And then here I have the mass of my, say, rho mesons. So I have some range where these spin one particles are light. Okay. It turns out that just looking at the phenomenology of the rho mesons and the omega and phi, there were two interrelated phenomenological ideas that have been discussed. Okay. One is called vector meson dominance, okay, which is basically the statement that when photons interact with hadrons, they seem to do it primarily through mixing with the vector mesons, so that when a photon interacts with pions, it seems like it's doing it through a rho. It's weird, right? Well, you know, these states carry electric charge. So photon is a gauge boson. It mixes with these vector mesons in a gauge invariant way through something called kinetic mixing. So, and then there's a related framework which we won't talk about, which is called hidden local symmetry, where you can actually understand the rho and omega, et cetera, as gauge bosons of some, quote, hidden gauge symmetry. Now, there isn't actually a gauge symmetry, right? These are not fundamental degrees of freedom, but they act as though they are gauge bosons. And we can kind of get some heuristic picture of why, that if I imagine now in the standard model, these vector meson dominance, et cetera, that works maybe up to about 2 GeV. So there's not like a huge energy range where you can do this. But if it were not a gauge boson, then you'd have longitudinal polarizations, operators that grow like 1 over m rho squared in here. Okay? And that is not consistent with effective field theory. Effective field theory has to have inverse powers of the cutoff. So what that tells me is that I want to actually have a cutoff that's up much above the mass of the vector. You essentially need to have a structure like gauge invariance. You can show that the gauge breaking operators are higher dimensional operators, so they give you suppressed interaction. So we won't go into any detail about this, but it's kind of if you're interested in that and want to get into the muck of hadronic physics, you can look it up. But the point being that this is a potential example of what we might call emergent gauge invariance, right? That it's like gauge symmetry doesn't have to be a fundamental thing, that you can have systems that don't seem to have that, and then you have the dynamics emerges. And we have some sense of why that might be required if I want to raise the cutoff arbitrarily high. I can't just couple the spin one particle however I want. So even just having this observed cutoff and the self-consistency of the theory pushes me towards this. And it doesn't explain everything, of course, in hadronic physics, but there's a lot of good predictions you can make by thinking of these as gauge bosons. And before the discovery of the Higgs, there were even people who were saying, well, maybe the W and Z bosons are composite, right? Maybe they are made up of some constituents, and when you go up to some high scale and that gauge invariance is actually emergent, right? So it's a very powerful tool, even if we don't think of it as like a fundamental property of particles. Okay, now I want to talk about experimental tests. I'm going to ask our friends in the booth if they would be willing to turn the screen on. Thanks. Cliff was suggesting I just like sketch Higgs constraint plots, but I've decided to spare you all my my embarrassing things.
So this idea about gauge symmetry to be like this emergent thing, is that related to why people say, oh, it's like, you know, pions have like approximate symmetry and it's like.
So the pions being Goldstone bosons, that symmetry is a global symmetry, and you can see that symmetry in the high energy theory. So for actual like real symmetries, if I transform my fields, the high energy and low energy theories have to have the same symmetry unless it's broken in the dynamics that confines the pion. So for instance, there's this chiral symmetry that gets spontaneously broken, but through confinement. But you can see a trace of the flavor symmetry from the UV in the fact that the pions are Goldstone bosons. This is a bit different because gauge symmetries are not actually symmetries, right? They're just a redundancy in the description. So there's nothing to like link up between these directions. But you're right that there's, I feel like, I'm not an expert at all in hadronic physics, I should say. I kind of dabbled mostly for my interest in hidden sectors and how you might have, say, a dark photon that's coupling with standard model in the low energy limit. But I think that, in people kind of forgot about a lot of this once you got to higher energies, because it's like, oh, cool, perturbative QCD. There's actually a lot of really interesting stuff. And ironically, I would say that for people who work on, for instance, confining hidden sectors, there's been a lot more people going back to like, wait, what were they saying in the 60s and 70s about hadronic physics? Because actually, there's a lot of cool and interesting and important lessons that were learned that have kind of not been lost, but are not really taught. And that's kind of why I wanted to include this example here. Okay. Higgs physics. We'll start with Higgs physics tests. Okay. And remember that the couplings are completely determined once we specify our the mass of the Higgs, that all of the masses come from VEVs and stuff. So we have different production modes. Okay. So the dominant production mode at the LHC, because the Higgs talks mostly to the top quark, right? The top Kukawa is quite large. Manuel was telling us about PDFs, that what you need to do is take partons, in this case gluons, from the proton, make a pair of top quarks that then annihilate, and I can make a Higgs this way. That's the dominant production mode. And this is just the QCD interaction strength. But here we have a top Yukawa that's feeding into the predictions of my production rates. Okay. So in measuring the production rate from gluon fusion, which is what this is called, we're indirectly probing the top Yukawa coupling. So that's these GGF. So what do these plots show? They show different decay modes of the Higgs and different production modes. So the left column is the production mode, the right column is the decay mode. What's being plotted is the ratio of the cross-section times branching fraction of the Higgs through this mode and production and decay mode divided by the standard model prediction. So all you really need to know is that the standard model is by definition this red line here, and then the points are the outcomes of Higgs measurements. So you can see, for instance, that gluon fusion is like bang on standard model, 1.04 plus or minus 0.09.
The arrows on the diagram, right?
Ooh, yeah. That would be fun. Okay, thanks. We also have something called vector boson fusion. So one way that you can get a Higgs out of light quarks, remember light quarks don't really feel Higgs very much, but they can emit gauge bosons like W's or Z's. And then these, remember there's this all-important gauge boson, Higgs vertex. This is another way you can produce it. You might say, well, how can we tell the difference? Well, the difference is that gluon fusion doesn't at leading order come with anything else. It's basically like a Higgs, and then you have your usual QCD crap, and that's it. Whereas in vector boson fusion, what you have are two energetic quarks that kind of go this way. So they kind of go into the forward regions of the detector, and then you have a Higgs that's produced there. So you can use these kinematic observables to try and distinguish those. Of course, it's not perfect. I mean, as we heard yesterday from Manuel's talk, that you always have to have candidates, and then you do fits and things to actually extract the expected rate. So the uncertainties are higher on this because this is a subdominant. It's like an order of magnitude lower than the gluon fusion rate. 1.2 plus or minus 0.2, it's pretty good, consistent with standard model. VH, this is called the Higgs-Strelung process. And it's basically the Higgs being radiated from a gauge boson. So this could be a W or a Z. W or Z. Again, that same all-important vertex. So these production modes are testing in different kinematic limits the different Higgs couplings. And this one is interesting because you can tag the associated gauge boson, right? So that's kind of the hallmark of this. Also, the Higgs boson is recoiling off of something, and so it can actually be quite energetic. And that means, for instance, that its decay products are more collimated. You can disentangle the Higgs decays from other standard model processes better. That's this VH. That's this set. Also pretty good. It's almost unnervingly good, actually. You'd expect maybe a little bit more scatter. But you know, the individual ones, of course, have significant fluctuations.
So is like VH gamma gamma and VH and Z?
That would be the Higgs decaying into photons.
Oh. Yeah.
or BB or whatever. So you'll notice that some of them, for instance, there's BB in VBF and VH, but not in the gluon fusion. That's because if I just look for inclusive bottom quark production, I mean, that rate is truly enormous. But if I'm using the other features of the event, then I can maybe pick out the bottom quarks. Of course, it's like not very effective for the VBF, but it's actually very effective here because I can use this and say, okay, now I know where to look for the Higgs. We heard a little bit about how you can use the substructure of jets, the patterns of this shower, to try and reconstruct the bottom quarks from here.
How do you get a separate experimental number for spectral boson fusion for WW and ZZ? Those are kind of...
Presumably, it has to do with the PDFs and the angular distribution, because you know the W's are purely left-handed. But I actually don't know that. That would be my guess. I mean, you can see that it's, yeah, not great. But I don't know. Yeah, that's worth. That would be my guess, at least. Finally, the last one that we have access to is the TTH production. Try and draw it over here. So again, we're using the fact that the top Yukawa is very large, so I can make top quarks through gluon fusion. And then I can like radiate a Higgs field off of this. Okay, and this is rare because I have a really heavy state. And remember, as we learned yesterday, that in the collisions of the gluons, those are actually peaked at lower fractions of the proton momentum. But the LHC has been running for long enough and high enough energy that there's an accumulation of pretty good statistics for here that when you combine all of the different ways, now it's actually competitive with the other production modes, which is really stunning. Yeah.
And there's a one sigma error, the statistical
one? Yeah, so the plus and minus are one sigma uncertainties. So the blue are systematic uncertainties and the yellow are statistical uncertainties. So, you know, statistical uncertainties, you can believe the error bar is. For systematic uncertainties, it's, you know, they're estimating what they think it is. So it might not be Gaussian in the same way as the statistical uncertainty is. Yeah.
So where's the Higgs connected to?
A top quark. So it can be radiated. Oh, I should put a bar over one of these, I guess. So it, you know, it can come off of the internal or the external lines.
Oh, take your pick.
Take your pick, yeah. You need to sum over all of them. So already, you know, even if you ignore the different decay mode stuff, if you just look at the kind of inclusive ones, you know, they're all a little bit high, maybe. Systematic uncertainties are also, you know, non-negligible, so maybe that's not so worrying. But, you know, given that we had not even discovered a Higgs boson and that these things could have been wildly different from the standard model predictions, this is a pretty amazing test, the standard model. Okay. And especially through the gluon fusion, we're also sensitive to new physics particles that couple the Higgs, right? Because if, let's say, I have some new particle that carries color charge, it's heavy, that talks the standard model Higgs, I can also have that running in the same loop, and it contributes just the same. So this puts pretty stringent constraints on other new physics scenarios as well. So, you know, things are looking pretty standard model-like from the production point of view. Questions about the production side? All right. What about the correlation between the coupling and mass, right? So remember, for fermions, we saw that for the fermions, gauge bosons, the fermion mass is proportional to V, okay? And then basically what the experiments do is say, okay, well, let's allow the normalization of the coupling to float, right? Like, let's not impose standard model requirements. And then let's determine what these values are. And it uses the fact that, you know, some of these particles show up in loops for some of the production modes, some of them show up in loops for the decay modes. The standard model prediction is the blue line. And again, that's like really incredible amount of testing. So, you know, the muon Yukawa coupling is tiny compared to the top Yukawa coupling. It's like 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 times the magnitude, and yet, okay, we don't even have a measurement of Higgs to mu mu yet, but we've been able to put limits that you see that it follows this pattern. So this is another thing that gives us confidence that the Higgs picture is correct, that the mass proportionality of the couplings holds up. Of course, there's always caveats in all of these things. Like, I think in this plot, the assumption is that the Higgs boson doesn't interact with any new particles. So for instance, you could imagine that if you put in a bunch of new stuff that created new production modes and new decay modes and there were cancellations, that, you know, maybe this, you can hide physics that way. There are other ways that you can do that, including just the direct measurements of the ratio of production to standard model prediction. But, you know, we got a very good fit from this. And so what we can do is extend this framework to particles that are not getting masses. So for instance, the Higgs couples to photons primarily through loops of charged particles like top quark, W boson, and so on. And so here, you know, basically all of the couplings to standard model particles are allowed to float. And you say, take all the global Higgs data, try to fit, you know, what are these as ratios relative to the standard model value under different assumptions. So for instance, the black dots are assuming that the Higgs cannot decay to particles beyond the standard model. The red dots are you're requiring that the coupling to gauge bosons be less than one. And that's usually reasonable if you're trying to unitarize the theory. It's easy to add sources of vector boson mass, but it's hard to subtract sources of vector boson mass. The blue is like the most agnostic. I think here they actually allow decays of the Higgs to invisible, or I guess in the blue it's just to something, and you're very agnostic about what that is. Okay, and you can see even when you relax a lot of the assumptions, you end up clustering on one. Interestingly, for the top quark, they can't quite nail down the sign of it yet, that there's the best fit region is actually for the wrong sign. But as you can see, there's large error bars on that. So again, this is giving us confidence that when we kind of zoom out and add together all of these Higgs production decay modes, it looks very standard model-like. Yeah.
Is the positive one minus one issue with kappa t related to the top quark sign that you get when you do top quark loops?
It's not really.
There's an ambiguity when you do top quark loops in process.
Yeah, I don't know. It might also be interference. I mean, it has to be some interference effect, right, that's showing up. So it's probably, yeah, it's showing up in a loop diagram interfering with something else, and there being an ambiguity about that. But I don't actually know which precise measurement allows that to happen. Yeah. OK, and this is just a summary, a kind of pictorial view of the summary of the production mode. So that's all pretty bang on. You can also consider more imaginative things, like when we went into unitary gauge, we had this scalar mode of the Higgs that coupled to standard model fermions. But you could say, well, let's just add a pseudoscalar coupling. Or in other words, let's add a complex phase to that. Okay, and we don't expect that, because we'll talk about this more tomorrow. But when you go into the mass eigenbasis, you diagonalize, you get real couplings of the Higgs to the fermions. So you can imagine, let's say I make it complex. This is going to, again, break gauge invariance. And you know, it's slower progress, because again, here you're really like if you're just looking at rates, you don't necessarily know if it's coming from a real part or a complex part. So you're looking at angular distributions. You're looking at differential cross sections and energy and stuff like that. Okay, so this is to the top coupling, and you can see that, you know, there's a large spread of uncertainties, but the you know, it's centered around CP violating couplings of zero and standard model coupling ratios of one. You can also do the same thing for coupling to the gauge bosons. Like you can couple, for instance, like if you imagine like the pion to two photon coupling, that has a different parity than the Higgs to photon coupling. And so again, by looking at angular distributions and so on, you can try and put constraints. The blue and the red are just different, basically, ways that you can parameterize the CP-violating couplings. But again, you can see that the central values are close to zero within one or two sigma. So you know, as we increase the luminosity of the LHC, or I'm not doing it, but other people who are better at experiments are increasing the luminosity of the LHC, it shows us there's still a long way to go. You know, there's lots of stuff that could be hiding here. And the more Higgs bosons we have, and the more we can slice and dice the data, the better we can get a handle on these other couplings. But just in terms of overall rates, looks pretty much like standard model Higgs. And you know, you're all too young to remember this probably. When the Higgs boson was discovered, everyone was really excited because the rate, like, they shouldn't have been able to discover it, and they did. So everyone's like, oh, cool, the best fit of this is like 2. And so everyone's building models to do that. And then, yeah, that went away. Yeah, and it happened for a lot of them too, like the TT Higgs production also, that was at like 2.5 plus or minus 0.5, and everyone's like, yes, and then, you know, 2 plus or minus 0.5, 1.5 plus or minus 0.5. So, you know, statistics are a pain. Okay, so we can also say, okay, well, this is Higgs, but, you know, people believed the standard model well before the discovery of the Higgs boson. And that's because of all of the other structure of the interactions, right? The fact that the W's interact with the left-handed ones, and the Z's are a linear combination of left and right-handed couplings. And the standard model is extremely predictive. And as I said in the first lecture, it's an over-constrained system, right? We have, if you exclude the neutrino mixing parameters, 19 parameters. And we have hundreds, if not thousands, of observations. So, you know, the simplest thing you could do is to say, let's take the most precise measurements to fix each of these 19 parameters and then measure other things and see if they're consistent. But of course, that's a fraught enterprise. So maybe a better thing to do is just measure a whole bunch of things, allow those parameters to float. And if you find that you can't simultaneously fit all of your observations, then that tells you that that your theory is broken, right? So you do a global fit, you look at the p-value, look at, you know, how much each individual observable is off. So there's all kinds of stuff in here. You know, strong gauge coupling, hadronic contributions, electromagnetic gauge coupling, masses, decay widths, weak mixing angle measured either at lepton colliders or hadron colliders, forward-backward asymmetries where, you know, if I have an E plus E minus machine or a PP bar machine, I can look at the difference between production and the direction of the particle versus the antiparticle beam. We have left-right asymmetry. So for instance, the SLD experiment collected data with polarized electron positron beams. And so you can say, okay, if they're in a plus, electrons are in a plus helicity state versus a minus helicity state, how did those rates change? So this is all getting at the left-handed versus right-handed chiral structure of the standard model. Ratios of decay modes, blah, blah, blah. So there's all sorts of stuff. And so this is a fit from early 2022 to you know, what this group called HEPFIT, and there are competing groups that do, you know, slightly different things, but often they converge on the rough takeaway. You know, they picked out the observables that they think are most sensitive to the unconstrained parameter of the standard model. Like, it might be that the electron mass doesn't really matter very much, so you're not going to put that in. And so they do the fit. I'm not going to show the values of the fit, but this shows, you know, if you look at the best fit value and you compare it to the measured value, how many sigmas off is it, roughly? And you can see it's, like, pretty good. Like, there's a scatter. There's some that are 1 to 2 sigma off. You know, there are some things that are a little bit discrepant with one another, but not in any significant way. The p-value of the global fit was 0.45, so that sounds good. So, yeah, no new physics. we only have 1 minute left, so I'll just...
Before I leave that one, what do the colors mean? Red, blue, and green?
I have no idea, actually. Yeah, I don't know. So I should say that the way that these particular ones... I misspoke. The way these particular ones were calculated were not the difference between the fit value and the measured value. What they did was they removed each variable in turn, did a fit with like n minus 1 observables, then they used the parameters to predict the value of the one they left out and compared it. So maybe the red and green has something to do with either things that are sensitive to particular corrections or you know, yeah. But I can look it up. But the thing that maybe throws a wrench in this, although maybe not. This was just showing that you also, you know, like, you can predict masses of, for instance, the top of the W boson. In April 2022, the CDF experiment, which is part of the Tevatron, so, you know, stopped running in 2010, maybe, or 2011, came up with a measurement of the W mass that seems way off, 7 sigma off from the standard model. And so there's legitimate questions, because you know there's also discrepancies with Atlas measurements, and Atlas had another measurement that came out after this that was in agreement with their original one. So you know we can talk about whether this is right or wrong, but if you take this at face value, then this kind of mucks up your fit. So for instance, if you redo the fit, now you get you know, the W mass being way off in the global fit. So five sigma, if you take, if you kind of naively combine the different W mass measurements, you probably shouldn't do that. They also did some kind of conservative combination where you inflate your error bars on your W to encompass the different measurements. But even in that conservative scenario, it's like three sigma off. If you do this thing where you remove each observable at a time and do the fit, you see kind of wild fluctuations, right? So, you know, we can talk, we'll talk about some more experimental stuff at the beginning of next time, but just to put out there that like, you know, in some sense we've gotten so used to things working that when something doesn't work, we're just kind of like, what? Like, the, you know, we're so used to the electric precision measurements being on. Of course, this could just turn out to be an experimental artifact or something like that. But if that measurement is real and it's confirmed by other experiments, this beautiful electroweak fit no longer works. The p-value is crappy. So we will leave it there. I'm happy to answer any questions. But those of you who want to go down and get coffee can start filtering down to coffee.